Welcome to the debate. If you break your leg, the medical fix is pretty obvious. You set the bone, you apply a cast, and you just let it heal. The body is essentially treated like an engine, and the doctor is the mechanic.
Right, a very straightforward mechanic.
Exactly. But what happens when the very feeling of profound loneliness starts physically destroying your immune system? Or, when chronic shame alters your cellular biology? Do we treat the white blood cells? Or do we treat the loneliness?
And see, that is the exact point where the mechanics manual completely falls apart. I mean, when you step into the world of chronic inflammation, autoimmune conditions, and severe trauma, you are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely entangled with human experience.
It gets messy.
Incredibly messy. Finding a faulty valve and replacing it is clean. But treating a physiological crisis that's driven by a person's relationship to the world, that's a whole different ballgame.
And that messy intersection is exactly our focus today. We are examining Dr. Bechara Salili's white paper. It's called Emotioning and Living Coherence. Dr. Salili takes this concept of emotioning, which is a term coined by the Chilean biologist Humberto Mazzarana, and applies it to affective biology, disease, and really how we heal.
Yeah.
So the central question we're debating today is this. Does framing emotion as a biological relational configuration offer a revolutionary synthesis for clinical care? Or does it conceptually overextend itself by simply repackaging existing neuroscience in philosophical language while maybe risking some dangerous clinical passivity?
Well, I'll be taking the position that while Dr. Salili's framework is undeniably elegant and it is very thought-provoking, its conceptual relabeling of established biological models may be clinically redundant.
Redundant? Really?
Yes, redundant. And furthermore, its reliance on this concept called non-forcing action to treat patients might be insufficient and perhaps even hazardous when you're dealing with acute, life-threatening pathology.
Okay, well, I will argue that this framework is actually a profound leap forward. I don't believe it's just philosophical relabeling. I think it brilliantly bridges the gap between raw neural mechanisms and our lived experience, fundamentally redefining what disease actually is and, demanding a much more biologically accurate approach to healing.
All right, let's ground this in the current state of science before we tear into the philosophy. Modern affective neuroscience has given us incredible insights into how stress and trauma work, but the field is heavily fragmented.
Oh, highly fragmented. I mean, if you walk into a hospital today, depression is treated in one wing as a chemical serotonin deficit.
Right.
Trauma is treated in another wing as an overactive amygdala. And then autoimmune disorders are treated somewhere else entirely as a T-cell malfunction.
Exactly.
What Dr. Salili argues is that Mazzarana's concept of emotioning actually solves this fragmentation. In this view, emotions aren't just subjective, psychological feelings trapped inside a person's head. They are physical, biological configurations that specify exactly what actions are possible for the organism in that given environment.
Okay, but wait, we already have robust scientific models that explain this without requiring an entirely new philosophical vocabulary. I mean, I read this paper and I see incredibly solid, established concepts just being given a new coat of philosophical paint.
A new coat of paint?
Yeah. Take the concept of active inference or Lisa Feldman Barrett's theory of constructed emotion.
Well, for those who might not spend their weekends reading cognitive science papers, how would you define active inference in this context?
Sure. So active inference is the idea that your brain is locked in a dark, silent skull. It has no direct access to the outside world. So it is constantly hallucinating or predicting what the body needs to do next to survive based on past experience.
Right.
Interoception is the brain constantly tracking internal data, heart rate, digestion, temperature. And allostasis is the brain preemptively releasing hormones and energy to meet a predicted challenge before it even happens. These models already perfectly explain how the brain anticipates what the body requires to survive a stressful environment.
They explain the internal mechanics, yes, but they often treat the brain as an isolated prediction machine. Dr. Salihelli's paper masterfully synthesizes Jokpangsepp's primary process emotional systems, those ancient, evolutionarily conserved circuits we share with all mammals like seeking, fear, and play, with Antonio Damasio's work on bodily feelings. By bringing in emotioning, the clinical focus shifts outward. We stop isolating the brain and start looking at the relationship. We stop asking what emotion is broken inside this person, and we start asking what world of action is being brought forth between this organism and its environment.
I just question whether that distinction actually changes how a doctor treats a patient.
It changes everything.
Does it?
Renaming a physiological stress response as costly conserved effective drift, which is the paper's term for chronic illness, is beautifully descriptive. I'll grant you that.
Thank you.
Redefining trauma as conserved defensive emotioning sounds poetic, but it risks blurring the critical line between a behavioral adaptation to a tough environment and a hard mechanistic pathology that requires medical intervention. I completely disagree that it's just poetry. The reason emotioning adds necessary scientific value over current predictive models is that it acknowledges the organism as an active participant in its environment, not just a passive prediction machine.
But hold on, let me finish this thought. The paper brings in Catherine Pyle Kaufman's theory of emotional sentience. She argues that emotion isn't just a reaction, it is a primary sensory system. It's a self-regulatory sense evaluating whether the environment is actively harmful or beneficial to our survival. But active inference already accounts for the environment. The brain predicts the environment.
Let me use an analogy to clarify the difference here. Relying strictly on allostasis and interoception is like meticulously measuring a car's engine temperature, its fuel injection rates, and its RPMs.
Okay.
You can have a perfectly tuned Ferrari engine, but if you drop it in a muddy swamp, it's going to overheat and destroy itself trying to move forward. Traditional medicine keeps trying to fix the Ferrari's radiator.
Right.
Predictive processing says the Ferrari is predicting a smooth road and getting confused. Emotioning forces the clinician to recognize the swamp. You simply cannot understand the engine's massive metabolic effort without knowing the terrain it is structurally coupled to.
I mean, I like the car analogy, but I really have to push back on the idea that current science ignores the swamp. This terrain mapping you are talking about is thoroughly covered by existing relational biology. Consider Coban and Sparra's social baseline theory, which, by the way, Dr. Sahali actually cites.
Right, the idea that human brains evolved to outsource risk to other humans?
Exactly. We evolved in tribes. The human brain literally calculates that the presence of a trusted partner reduces perceived risk.
Mm-hmm.
If you are standing at the bottom of a hill holding the hand of a friend, your brain will visually perceive the hill as less steep than if you are standing alone. Your brain lowers the metabolic effort needed to climb it. We already know that trusted relationships alter physiology.
Yes, we do.
So, if the neurovisceral integration model already links social support to heart rate variability and stress adaptation, why introduce Majorana's concept of love as a domain of coexistence? It feels like we are substituting measurable data like parasympathetic tone for, well, philosophical flourishing.
Because the numbers on a heart rate variability monitor don't tell you the meaning of the organism's adaptation. And look, this isn't just academic hair splitting. When the brain maps a hostile terrain, it fundamentally changes the physical architecture of the body. And that forces us to redefine what a disease actually is. This is where the paper moves from theory into profound clinical reality.
You referring to the idea of disease as a trapped defense mechanism?
Yes. The text makes a really powerful claim. Much of what we call chronic disease can be understood as a defensive emotioning that once served survival, but became trapped. It became that costly, conserved, affective drift. Let's look at the evolutionary biology here through George Slevich's social safety theory.
Right, the link between social isolation and the immune system.
Precisely. To an ancient human, being separated from the tribe didn't just mean you felt sad. It meant you were probably going to be attacked by a predator or, you know, die of a physical wound. You were exposed. So through millions of years of evolution, the brain learned to treat social rejection as a physical emergency.
Mm-hmm.
If a patient today is experiencing chronic shame, systemic humiliation, or chronic loneliness, the brain anticipates a physical injury.
It preemptively inflames the body.
It radically alters inflammatory tone. It ramps up pro-inflammatory cytokines to prepare for a wound, and it simultaneously decreases antiviral defenses. Because, I mean, if you are isolated, you aren't around other humans to catch a virus from anyway.
Right.
The shame literally becomes a physiological state of high allostatic load. The disease isn't a broken machine.
It is the organism intelligently preparing for a threat that is socially rather than physically mediated.
Look, I don't dispute the psychoneural immunology. It is well documented that social threat drives inflammation-related disease risk. My concern is how this philosophy gets operationalized in a clinic.
How so?
Well, the paper has a section on limits and safeguards, and reading it, I saw a massive danger of what the author terms therapeutic moralism.
Meaning the risk of blaming the patient for their illness?
The ultimate victim blaming. If we start viewing metabolic disease, cardiovascular risk, or autoimmune activation primarily as a conserved affective pattern, if we frame it as a physical manifestation of a person's chronic shame or grief, we risk unintentionally blaming the patient's emotional world for their pathology.
That's a stretch.
Is it? Imagine looking at a patient with severe insulin dysregulation or rheumatoid arthritis and asking, what defensive emotioning are you holding on to?
Oh, come on. But that ignores the structural factors the paper highlights.
It obscures the mechanics of the disease. If a patient is living in a food desert, breathing air choked with particulate matter, and carrying genetic markers for autoimmune disease, their illness is mechanical and environmental.
Right, but let me just say, warning against therapeutic moralism in a white paper is one thing, but when you train a generation of clinicians to view illness as a loss of living coherence, human nature dictates they will start looking for psychological root causes where there are only biological or toxicological ones. I fundamentally disagree that the framework obscures mechanics. It contextualizes them. The paper explicitly warns against the romantic vitalism you're worried about.
It does warn against it, yes.
It acknowledges that toxins, material deprivation, and structural violence are real physical aspects of the environment the organism is coupling with. But it asks the clinician to look at the patient as an autonomous living system doing exactly what it was designed to do, conserve its viability.
Okay.
If someone is hypervigilant because of systemic poverty, their immune system is inflamed because their body believes it is under constant attack. The illness is the biological cost of that continuous defense.
All right, assuming we accept that premise, it brings us to the most radical and frankly, the most problematic proposition in the text. If we accept that chronic illness is a biological defense mechanism locked in the on position, the obvious medical question is, how we turn it off? How do we treat this?
Right. The paper introduces the concept of non-forcing action, heavily drawing on the philosophical concept of Wu Wei. The premise is straightforward, but deeply challenging to modern medicine. Because living systems are autonomous and structurally determined, you cannot command an organism to change its affective state from the outside.
You can't order a patient to feel safe.
Exactly. You cannot prescribe trust, playfulness, or curiosity. Instead, the text argues the clinician must use disciplined biological respect to create the conditions of safety. The doctor acts as a regulatory presence, allowing the organism to slowly reorganize itself out of that trapped defensive posture into a wider domain of possible action.
And this is where the framework falls apart for me as a universal clinical standard.
Why?
The text suggests that forcing change violates the living organization. But what happens in cases of severe psychiatric crisis or physiological allostatic overload, where the organism's self-regulatory capacity has utterly collapsed?
Well, the clinician still has to establish safety as the primary intervention.
But sometimes establishing safety requires aggressive forcing action. If a patient is in a state of severe metabolic crisis, or an acute psychiatric breakdown driven by a deeply conserved defensive attractor, say, acute mania, or a severe depressive episode, waiting for the organism to reorganize itself through attuned presence and non-forcing action is dangerously passive.
Non-forcing action does not mean doing nothing.
But the paper explicitly cautions against compliance-based medical interventions. Sometimes the engine actually is broken, and the mechanic needs to step in and forcefully replace the part.
No.
Whether that is through aggressive pharmacology, involuntary psychiatric holds to prevent suicide or emergency surgery. The poetry of Wu Wei fails entirely when the patient's biology is actively destroying itself in real time.
I find that critique overly reductive because you are equating non-forcing action with clinical hesitation.
Am I?
Yes. The text is very clear that Wu Wei involves highly specific, active steps. It means providing material security. It means restoring bodily rhythm. It means reconnecting the patient to a sense of legitimacy. And there is a hard biological reason it cautions against compliance-based coercion.
Which is what?
Let's go back to Jock Panksepp's affective systems. If a patient's pathology is fundamentally an organism's conserved orientation toward future harm, if they are biologically locked in a panic, grief, or fear state, how can forceful coercive medical interventions do anything but trigger the exact same threat detection systems that caused the illness in the first place?
You are assuming all medical intervention is perceived as a threat.
When a doctor uses external command, demands rigid compliance, or completely ignores the patient's autonomy, the patient's brain registers that interaction as a social threat. Their amygdala lights up, their HPA axis dumps cortisol into the bloodstream, and their immune system prepares for further injury.
Look,
You might force temporary physiological compliance, you might get the blood pressure down for an hour, but you are biologically driving them deeper into the underlying pathology. You are proving to their nervous system that the world is indeed a hostile terrain.
I am certainly not arguing for cold, unfeeling medicine. I think every clinician would agree that a dismissive, coercive clinic generates a biological cost, but there is a massive spectrum between coercive humiliation and disciplined biological respect. My point is about regulatory flexibility.
You mean the capacity of the nervous system to shift states?
Yes. When a patient's regulatory flexibility is entirely gone, when their heart rate variability is tanked, and they are locked in a rigid neural immune feedback loop, the clinician sometimes has to impose form from the outside to break that loop.
By forcing it.
You use the heavy medication to force the physiology back to a baseline. You artificially stabilize the system so that the patient even has the cognitive and biological capacity to engage in the relational repair you're talking about.
And Dr. Saheli's framework absolutely does not preclude medication. It simply reframes its purpose. Under this model, medication isn't fixing a broken gear in a machine. It's a strategic perturbation.
A strategic perturbation.
Yes. It's a tool used to help expand the domain of possible action. It gives the nervous system just enough breathing room so the person can finally start to feel safe, to relate to their environment without collapsing, to mourn their grief, and to eventually access the Panksepp play system, which is where real neural reorganization actually happens.
That sounds like a wonderful ideal, but framing the doctor primarily as someone who creates a field for reorganization undercuts the very real, very necessary authority required in modern medicine to make life-saving unilateral decisions. When someone is in a cytokine storm, I don't want a clinician pondering my domain of coexistence. I want them pushing corticosteroids.
And I would argue it redefines medical authority into something far more humane, biologically accurate, and ultimately effective long-term. We are nearing the end of our time, so let's synthesize where we stand on Dr. Saheli's work.
Go ahead.
From my perspective, the Mathuranan framework of emotioning successfully shifts our entire paradigm of care. By viewing patients not as broken machines, but as intelligent living systems trying to conserve patterns that once protected their viability, we can finally integrate immunology, neuroscience, and relational safety. It gives clinicians a rigorous, scientific language to understand that to truly heal the human body, we must restore its viable, safe coupling with the world.
And to summarize my position, the model provides a beautifully profound narrative for therapeutic empathy. It brilliantly highlights the steep biological cost of social threat. However, clinicians must ensure that the poetry of living coherence doesn't overshadow the established hard physiological mechanisms of disease. We must remain vigilant that the ideal of non-forcing action doesn't become an academic excuse for clinical hesitation when direct, forceful medical intervention is necessary to save a life.
Despite our strong disagreements on how this translates to, say, the emergency room, it seems we have found significant convergence on the biological reality of the social safety theory.
Absolutely.
The evolutionary evidence is undeniable. Isolation, systemic humiliation, and social rejection are not just sad emotional experiences. They are deeply, measurably, biologically costly. They drain metabolic resources, spike inflammation, and drastically increase disease risk. Creating relational safety in a medical setting is not just about having a nice bedside manner. It is a strict, undeniable medical imperative.
Which really leaves us with a fundamental question about the trajectory of healthcare. If the human body isn't just a mechanical engine, but a living, sensing system constantly mapping and adapting to its terrain, we have to look beyond the clinic. Does the future of medicine lie in finding better pharmaceutical tools to fix the organism? Or does it lie in changing the world the organism is structurally forced to survive in?
A profound question we will leave our listeners to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on The Debate.